This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin. I am back after so many weeks away. It feels strange to be back in this seat, but I'm happy to be here because I am joined by two fantastic, not robots, Nick White.
Hey.
And Tia Vasiliou.
I really would like to know more about the robot thing.
Okay, so long story short, someone called me out for saying fantastic human beings like every single episode. And I was like, huh, I guess I didn't realize I did that. And I listened to the beginnings of like 10 episodes. I was like, oh shit, I say that every single week. So I've been trying to change it up.
I thought that was on purpose.
It was, but I guess it's annoying. I don't know.
I'm sorry, also, I'm a human being that observes patterns. Sorry, my life doesn't vary enough for you. Jeez.
I'm joined this week by two incredible humanoids.
I would really prefer the robot body, actually, if we like had a choice. Can I just trade?
Yes, we will get right on that in the I Read Comic Books Research Center today, in the Tia Vasiliou Robotics Department.
Oh, Mike, you're a computer guy. Get on that.
Joined by Nick White and uploaded digital interface Tia Vasiliou.
Yeah. Eventually, this podcast will just be pressing like a series of dubstep remix buttons, and it'll be simulating the two other people on
the
show.
Mike Rappin will be the only and two entity. Great aimbots. Who I have eventually discovered are actually capable of taking these people's jobs.
We were talking earlier this week at work about, like, are you a cyborg if your robot parts aren't human shaped?
Well, I thought the definition
right,
between a robot,
isn't the whole idea that an android is shaped like a human?
Right, but a cyborg, like, so you're like you're most
is a human
like,
with
human. And robot?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is the I Like Robots podcast.
Yeah, this is serious now. This is...
See, this is the biggest debate when we had the site Destroy the Cyborg, and the question was, who is the cyborg that we're destroying? And I kept saying, it's all of us. And then I would get a lot of silence, and we would move on. So let me ask the question I ask every week on this show. Oh, God. How have you been? How have you both been? How have comic books been? Let's start with Tia.
I'm in a lot of pain, and that's why I want a robot body. I think that I might actually develop some sort of pyrokinesis because my body feels like it's on fire right now.
What?
I just am not doing great.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you. I have read some comics, though. Those are good.
Such as, what have you been reading? I mean, I've listened to what you've been reading for the last couple weeks, but what have you been reading recently outside of that stuff?
So, speaking of being on fire, I read Redlands number 2 by Jordi Belair and Vanessa Del Rey and Clayton Coles. We did determine that's the correct pronunciation, yes?
Yes,
based
yes.
on Twitter research? Okay.
Via pinned tweet on his Twitter account.
And this is like some like nth level internet trolling, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, this was just such a breakout series for me. And number one, it's about these witches in this small town in Florida. And at first you're like, are they being persecuted by these bigots in this town? But then in the second issue, you're like, maybe the witches are also bad. And I love books like that where just everyone is bad.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in the back, so there's like this serial killer who I guess is stalking them somehow and is committing these murders. And then in the back of the book, there's these like blood Rothkos that I guess the serial killer made. They're great. I love it. Yeah, I love that bonus content. Please see our recent issue on Back Matter. Anyway, so Redlands number 2. Get on this book. Also, I think my favorite cover is every time, like so far it's 2 for 2.
Oh yeah, it's such beautiful covers just by themselves. They totally draw your eye in a very scary way.
I mean, also very gory. Gory and beautiful in the sense that like Hannibal is gory and beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Okay.
They remind me a lot of Harrow County and sort of the general feeling.
Oh,
Harrow County covers in terms of the feeling they elicit. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Totally.
Very fine art sort of, which, I hate that word, but you know.
As
I mean.
Someone who was just in Paris and went to the Louvre, it reminded
me
so much of all the things that I saw.
Credentials goes
the
to one museum
thing,
and
the only thing these covers are missing are Jesus, apparently. So,
And someone's exposed breasts. Yeah. Possibly, well, oh boy, I read comic books. If you get into religious commentary.
There's a lot of exposed breasts in the interiors, if that helps.
Yes, oh, it wow. helps. That, okay. that adds more of the Renaissance. I have no idea what I'm talking about. Tia, please move on.
Okay. All right. So moving on to robots and things of that sort, people with robot body parts. Dr. Aphra number 12.
Woo!
Woo! This is, is it a spoiler to say that Vader's back? Because that's literally the solicit text, and I was wow.
Canon would dictate that such might be a consequence of things, so that's, no, I don't consider that.
Remember when they announced Aphra, like, 2 seconds after the last Vader book was out, and everyone was like, oh god, is Aphra dead? And then like 5 seconds later, they're like, surprise, Dr. Aphra's getting her own book. And we're like, oh, I guess right. not.
Surprise, Star Wars is incapable of killing its extended characters too. Yeah.
But like, I'm glad they didn't, because Aphra's great.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is kind of the, is this the conclusion of the story arc where she was selling the Jedi consciousness in the crystal that,
oh boy, I'm so far behind on this book. I only Holocron? Read the first volume.
It's still unclear to me if it's a real Jedi consciousness or what, because like it seems like Luke didn't really believe her. I don't know what happened with her and Luke. Things happened, and like so that was a long time ago. I don't know. Anyway, she is, you know, in a little bit of a tough spot because her murder droids are like, you know, tired of being told what to do. And so they've orchestrated this whole thing to kind of release the really angry Jedi consciousness robot guy. And then Vader shows up, and I'm pretty sure they're going to kiss. By they, I mean Vader and the robot Jedi. Or they're going to kill each other. Maybe a little bit of both. Who can say?
Well,
I'm excited, regardless.
Right? I also read the conclusion of Four Kids Walk Into a Bank.
Woo!
I
really excited about that book.
Oh my god. All right, so first of all, this is like not fucking around in any way, shape, or form.
Oh,
I
yeah.
cannot believe where they went with this. I yeah, cannot like, believe it.
No spoilers, because really people gotta read this goddamn book.
Oh my
book.
God. And you know, this we can talk more about this later when we get into the topic, but I love that on the title page the artist is credited first, and then the flatter, and then the letterer. And they even credit the person who does the wallpaper design. The writer, Matthew Rosenberg, is credited last. So we have Tyler Boss on art and design. We have Claire DeZutti on flatting, which, guys, flatting is so important. And, like, no one ever gives them any credit. I love that they put her in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Maurer on lettering. The lettering in this book is also fantastic, and we'll talk more about that later. Wallpaper design by Courtney Menard. I'm so happy to see everyone getting their name in the book, you know?
Totally.
And then, finally, I read Runaways number one, and I, like, basically cried through the whole thing.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, don't even get me started on that. I read that right before the show, and I was like, why did I do that to myself?
Rainbow Rowell with Chris Anka on art and Matthew Wilson doing the colors. So you know that it's just going to be the most like gorgeous, sexy book ever. Except this first issue actually just was really sad. And it was like, I don't know. So Nico, her power with her staff, like she can't use a spell more than once.
Yeah.
And I mean, just think about how stressful that would be if you're like in a situation and there someone's like, I need this to happen right now. And you have to like think of every spell you've ever done. Because if you do a repeat, it gets mad at you. And so she's in a situation where someone she cares about very much is really badly hurt and she needs to help them. And she doesn't know what to do because she's done these spells a million times. And, you know, the pacing of this issue and the way that they really get you into the like the intensity and the helplessness that you just feel so scared, and it's it was really effective.
Yeah, as someone who read the original like run, this like this hurt in ways that I forgot about.
Oh yeah, yeah. You, I was talking on another show about how like I like how you have to kind of maybe go back and read the original. Like, this book assumes you know who they are.
Oh, yeah. Marvel's not even messing around with this book.
I really like that.
Picking up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a real moment of schadenfreude when Jordan picked that up, and he looked real happy, and he was really ready to take it home. And then I was like, Jordan, have you read any of the other Runaway books? He's like, no. I'm like,
oh,
well,
no.
You're supposed to. So now I get to gatekeep.
Oh, God. No, we're just going to skip Nick. We're going to skip Nick this week.
Yeah. Who's Jordan?
He's a friend of mine. We frequently go and get our comic books together, and he was really excited to get that book, and I was like, I've been told by multiple people you need to read the other ones, and Jordan's a relatively nonplussed person, so he...
Jordan, if you're listening, I'll be your new friend.
Yeah.
I won't be mean to you like Nick is.
So I just want to point out, it's been 128 episodes, and Nick has talked about Jordan on many episodes, and
he
no
might
one's
not be
called
real.
Him out on it.
Yeah.
And I just think it's funny that it's taken us 128 episodes for someone to go, who is Jordan?
Yeah. Let's look into this.
If
is
only
Jordan
slowly
real?
The facade crumbles.
Yeah. Jordan, if you're real, I'm your new friend.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to have to create a new personality.
Anyways.
It's basically Diane from Twin Peaks, so everyone can appreciate that.
I see.
I've never
I
seen see. Twin Peaks.
Yeah, neither have I. So you're zero yeah. for zero yeah. so far today, Nick.
Yeah, I know. Hitting it out of the park.
Tia, did you read anything else this week?
That's pretty much it. We should probably move on.
Okay, Nick, what about you? what have you been reading? How
when I'm
you
not
been?
Telling people to put comic books back on the shelf.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah, I read a few books. Obviously, as I just said, things have been busy. Recently went and picked up my books yesterday, met Kate and Jordan and got our comics in GR, and then sat down and we had dinner together, and I attempted to explain the adpocalypse to Kate. And once again, I got the not really on YouTube that much speech, which is fine because there are pretty good reasons to not be on there all the time as well.
Oh, you're talking about the whole ad removal stuff from various videos and from a couple,
yeah,
bunch of different channels?
Yeah, demonetization, the whole ad demonetization thing on YouTube. It's,
gotcha.
It's a fascinating thing. People should read up on that. It's interesting. But I did read some things. I'm proud to say that I performed a public service. Danny came to me a few weeks ago and tweeted and asked if I had read Divinity Zero. And I said no, because I don't read books until about 3 to 4 months after they come out, so I'll get back to you on that. and he was wondering if it was a good jumping on point for Valiant, because one of Valiant's favorite things is saying that every single issue is a great jumping on point. And they're not, but we won't get started on that, at least not too
right.
much. This
right.
is not a good jumping on point. It totally is not. I know a lot of people are looking at this, and Valiant's saying it's fantastic for such, but it is a terrible jumping on point. It's a great refresher. It's fantastic if you read some Valiant books, but not all Valiant books, and you want to sort of be caught up to speed on where all of the different runs have recently wrapped and sort of the repercussions of those and the fallout, especially those surrounding Divinity 3. So, mm-hmm. yeah, if you want to get on board with Valiant, not a great book. If you sort of want to know where things have gone since Divinity 3, it's great for that. It's a fantastic book by Matt Kent. Renato Guedes does the art, and he also did the art on Bloodshot Reborn Zero, as well as Eternal Warrior Awakening. And I can honestly say this is probably his best work of the three. Yeah, so don't get me started on this whole thing. I'm starting a political action committee against this whole jumping on thing. It's called CAPES. That's Citizens Against Proclaimed Entry Stories. So this is
you've given this way too much thought.
Yeah,
I'm you know? So happy right now. Danny, look what you've done.
These are the things that I choose to care about.
Yeah.
Which after that one, I was like, you know what? I'm a comedian. We can roll with this. So I also came up with my other political action committee for event books that do shit, which is Souls Urging for Further Event Repercussions, a.k.a. Suffer. So these are two groups that you can join in the future if you really vehemently believe in one of those two causes or both. So
we'll have t-shirts printed up by the end of the week, everyone.
But yeah, TLDR, Danny. I mean, I guess you already have the book, I think, so read it, but you might not find it that enlightening or helpful. The recent one-shot, which I think is called Rye, discovers the Valiant Universe, or it's like Rye in the Valiant Universe. It's written by Rafer Roberts, art by Francis Portella, I think. That does a much better job. Still not a perfect job, but a much better job. So there's that. I read Black Hammer 10. Yes, I'm a few issues behind. I really like that with this book, Jeff Lemire has understood that with a team book, one of the things you really need to pay attention to is you don't add too many more characters without finding ways to, quote-unquote, subtract other characters from the book, so that we don't have too many people to follow, and I think he's kept a really good balance with that. In a way, this book has followed Southern Bastard's arc trajectory, which is following arc one. Arc two just turns into a huge prologue arc, very much character study developed, and with maybe like 10 to 15% of the issues sort of taking place in modern day and at least having a little bit of a forward trajectory on the book. And much like Southern Bastards, it actually works. A lot of times this whole prologue arc is like, oh my god, here we go, six issues of like backstory. Ugh, I don't know if I can put up with this. But sometimes if it's written really well and it's actually interesting and you know that the character is, the creator is really setting a quality foundation, you don't mind as much. And that's how I feel about Black Hammer, which, interestingly enough, you want to talk about comics getting mentioned by, you know, entertainment bigwigs. I know that M. Night Shyamalan was actually just talking about Black Hammer, I think on Twitter, and also the people that were at the comic shop where he bought it were, you know, tweeting about it and how he really enjoyed the book. So celebrities are like normal people too. They read things, they're literate, and sometimes they enjoy them.
Well, except that his movie that, what was the movie that he just did that was so
Splice or Slice or
Split.
The Split. Yeah, I'm
it
sorry.
Was so it was so misogynist. I actually like probably rage stroked and blacked out for half of it.
Oh wow.
So please keep him away from Black Hammer, because I don't know if I want him putting his grubby little woman hating hands all over that.
Yeah.
He is short. so little works. Okay, well, new on I Read Comic Books, sometimes we like things, and sometimes people, we don't like those things too, and internal turmoil happens because of it. So,
yes.
I also read XO 6. This is, of course, the sixth issue of the new XO Man of War run by Matt Kint. This arc is being drawn by Doug Brathwaite. The whole, like, Flash Gordon space pulp thing is starting to run just a little thin for me. I think we're going to get a real quantum shift in this book soon anyway. Arik of Dacia's armor seems to be really striking out on its own. You know, it used to sort of just, like, sit in that little ball and, like, talk to him or whatever. But, like, now that shit ain't playing around anymore. Like, it's hovering around all over the goddamn place, like, as a fully formed armor suit, like, with him just not there. So it's just faceless armor. That's basically, you know, basically telling Arik, you know, you don't tell me what to do, Dad. You're not in charge.
It's getting really like Hell 9000 almost. Like,
oh, it's worse than that. Like, it's like a, you know, 15-year-old teenager that doesn't want to listen to curfew. Like, that's what this armor is verging on now. But it really made me think about the whole design of this book, and I think, you know, this is something we can talk about later, maybe a little, but it's interesting how Valiant's been renaming a lot of their books when they do a new arc. So, like, for example, with, like, Marvel, you know, you have 500 different versions of Squirrel Girl, and so you have to be like, oh, this is Incredible Squirrel Girl, or no, this is Amazing Spider-Man versus, you know, Super Interesting Spider-Man, all new, all different Spider-Man. And then people go, well, what does that mean, or when was that run? And so you have to give, like, a year or whatever. So you have, like, Spider-Man 2017, Spider-Man 2015, whatever. And Valiant has sort of circumvented that by kind of coming up with new permutations or combinations for its book's titles. So XO Man of War is now just like XO. Archer and Armstrong just became A&A. Ninjak is now going to be Ninja K, I think, next month, even though that actually makes a lot of sense because you know, it's much like James Bond, Ninjak is sort of a role and it gets passed down. And this book is actually going to highlight the other, like Ninja A and Ninja B and all that. So it's kind of interesting that they do that. I'm Ninjab. Of a mixed mind. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's interesting. I was just thinking yesterday, I was like, does this work or does this not work? So I guess something to think about. It's certainly what I choose to spend my available brain power on. So sad, as Trump would say. Sad exclamation point, I guess. Great.
Oh, boy.
Political commentary. It's going to happen. Finally, I read Chew Volume 5. I love this book. I love this book. I love this book so much. Everyone needs just a wild and zany, just absolutely insane book that they read. And this book is just so imaginative. It's so crazy. It's world building in the weirdest ways. This volume was absolutely insane. Tony Chu gets kidnapped by this guy who is deciding that he's decided that it's a good idea that he wants to tell a story. He wants to write a nonfiction book about baseball players' sexual exploits. I'm not making this up.
Yeah.
And okay, but that was literally a plot point in the show Switched at Birth.
Was it?
Was it really?
It really was.
And so he digs up all of these exhumed exhumes all of these baseball players' bodies, and he has Tony eat them so he can learn about their sexual past, because of course Tony, when he eats anything, he learns its history. And so
that's not how it happened in Switched at Birth.
Yeah, I was gonna say not. I have the feeling there's a point where these two stories diverge.
Yeah,
it's so weird.
And I wonder if John Layman was like making fun of Switched at Birth, or like if this is just some coincidence.
Yeah. Oh, sick burn. What is that on, like Fox Family or whatever?
Oh God, no! It's the one that changed names in the Shadow Hunter.
ABC. That is the one. ABC on Family is now. Yeah. Oh, what is it called now?
Freeform.
Yes.
Freeform.
Bingo. You got it, Tia. That's it. That's how you know it's good.
Could you imagine what we could accomplish if we used this brain power for like other things?
Anything other than yeah, literally I was gonna say, Tia, you don't need to get that picky. It's like everything else. Literally anything else.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my favorite things with this book is that they keep finding all of these characters have weird food-derived powers. Someone can eat the food and give you the chemical breakdown. Tony can eat the food, and then he he learns the past and the history of it, so that's why he's such a great detective. But we have a new character who... God, what is his ability? It's like a Shokau... a Coco Scalpere, which of course, if you know your Latin, you know what they're getting at there. And his ability is to create anything like a fully functioning articulated machine out of chocolate. So he can build anything out of chocolate. And he builds guns because he's an arms dealer. And then he, of course, decides what would be better than just chocolate firearms. And of course, the answer is laser-fueled chocolate firearms. Why isn't everyone reading this book? This is just,
it's been coming out for like 8 years. I mean, it's all out there. Everyone should go out there and read that book. Yeah, it is finished now.
Yeah. Oh my God. And that's a big pro. If you were like, gosh, I don't want to read a book. And we all know these people. My dad's the same way with like books. Like I gave him volume one of The Fade Out and he's like, where's volume two? And I'm like, not out for a few months. Well, not interested. Okay. So for those people, this book is done, and there's a lot of it. So there you go. Read this book. I love it, love it, love it. It's fantastic. Mike and Xander both completely right in terms of this being just it's a tough book to explain to people, but it's massively enjoyable. So that's what I've been reading.
Cool. I've been gone for 3 weeks, so I read so many comic books. It's like I have letters literally falling out of my ears. I can quickly go through some of them, but I did read all of the Matt Fraction, David Aja, Hawkeye while I was traveling.
Oh, wow.
Like, God, that book is so good.
For the first time?
No. I reread it, I should say. I reread it for like the fourth time. Just because I wanted to refresh myself because I bought all the subsequent Hawkeye volumes that came out because I wanted to catch up to read the Kate Bishop series that's coming out. And so I read all of that and it's fantastic. We talk about that on every single episode of the show, so I don't need to go into that. You should just go read it. But as for recent stuff, I read Generation X number 6 by Christina Strain. I put this little heart emoji because she is my favorite comic book writer right now in terms of the X-Men. She's kicking so much ass on this book. There is a fun moment between, I think it's X-Men Gold and this book, or no, Iceman, sorry, between Iceman and this book. Where Quentin Quire is asking out, I can't remember, Idy, to go for sushi. And then in the other book, they have the same conversation. I love that just little parallel thing. I don't know what else to say about Generation X other than it's teen drama at its best, plus it's X-Men, and I love it. I also read Strong Female Protagonist, Book 1 by Molly Osterang and Brennan Lee Mulligan. I grabbed this in a sale because I really liked just the cover art of it, and it was on Super Duper Sale. And I did not expect this to be a book about superheroes, and it totally becomes that, while also making commentary, like very interesting commentary about how superheroes don't actually help people by fighting, and how they can use their powers for actual productive, real-world good. And there are some people out there who don't like this book because they feel like it's too... I don't know. Like, somebody called it feminist garbage on a website, and I was like, I did not get that at fucking all. This book is fantastic. It's a webcomic. It's still coming out, so it's like an ongoing series, but if you want, you can go grab the volume. I highly recommend it. The art is very beautiful. It's in black and white for the first, quote, 4 issues, but by 4 issues, they just mean 220 pages, so it's a lot of content in one book, and it's very cheap online and digital, or you can go read it all online for free, I think, at strongfemaleprotagonist.com. Fantastic book. I also read Destiny New York Volume 1, which is a book that I backed on Kickstarter a long, long time ago. Volume 2 is currently being kickstarted. I think they just reached their goal earlier this last week. I picked this up, or I backed it, because I remember Kieran Gillen tweeted it and said it looked really good, and I was like, oh, okay. So I backed it, and I never actually read it until I saw the second volume was coming out. So I read it this weekend, or over the last week, and this book is very, 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 very good in so many ways. It's a very diverse book. It takes the... I apparently am obsessed with witch comic books because it's all about, like, witches. I blame Tia completely for this.
I accept full responsibility.
And yeah, it's full of, like, a lot of multidimensional characters. It's all, like... The majority of people in this book are women, and I really was just impressed by how they tackled some of the problems and character relationships in this story. I've never seen some of the aspects and some of the just approaches were just so very interesting to me. I was very impressed. I could not stop reading it. Like, I basically had to pee at the beginning of the book, and I didn't stop reading the book to go to the bathroom. It's one of those types of things where you just have to read it. Get a UTI, read Destiny New York. That's the pull quote.
Are you looking to give yourself a kidney infection? If we got a book exactly. for you.
I think if you're looking for an interesting, diverse book that has some supernatural elements, that isn't pure in your face fantasy with elves and dwarves or whatever, but has just like a less goofy magic feel than Harry Potter, Destiny New York totally works. Honestly, go back this on Kickstarter. You can get both volumes for $20 right now on their Kickstarter. I cannot express how fantastic this book was. I don't know how to describe it. Like, I tried to write a description, but it's very, very cool. And I know that their Kickstarter does a way better job of explaining it. So just go check that out. It'll be in the show notes. I also read Sunstone Volume 1 by Stefan Sajic. And... this is a very sexy book.
What a fun, sexy time for you, yeah.
Exactly. It's a very interesting book because it's very focused on BDSM and like a sexual relationship between two women that basically is a thing that exists as them saying, we both have needs, we're not going to do anything more than just fulfill these needs, and then we will part. And then the romance of the story starts, which is really fun and an interesting way to look at how people interact with each other. This book has a lot of praise. I mean, Sajic's art is top-notch. I think if you see it, you immediately recognize it as his work. He did some stuff on Rat Queens. He did Witchblade for the longest time, and he did some stuff with The Darkness.
He's now on Aquaman.
And now he's on Aquaman currently. And Sunstone was this book that he started as kind of like a fun... I want to do something independent than my like actual Top Cow work. And so he created an alias online and started creating these just random strips that people got really attached to, and they were really curious about the story behind these strips. So he turned those just kind of fetishy.
Is this the images. One where a bunch, like some scenes, the like the outline of the panel will be very florid and decorated, and
yes, yeah, it's like ropes, yeah. And yeah, it's really beautiful. And I don't think that the book over sexualizes the women in the story in a way. And I don't know how to properly describe it because I just don't have the vocabulary to. But I was really impressed with how well the romance worked for someone who doesn't read romance. I was very pulled into the story, and the sexual part of it was like, the get that out of my face, I want to actually hear about how these two women like each other a lot.
Well, no, I mean, I think that there's a way that you can tell that kind of story, and the difference is that for the reader, like, you can tell when the sex scenes are for you or versus when they're for the characters,
right?
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that in volume one, there's some kind of goofy dialogue that I was kind of like, but I think that's like the romance side of things. I don't read a lot of romance stories, so maybe that's just like you kind of take a little bit of cheese with your cake. And yeah, I really liked it. I have all five volumes because I purchased them in a sale, and I was like, sure, why not? And I really like his art. I wanted to support the guy. I'm totally going to read the rest of this book. Finally, Fonte Bukowski Volume 2 by Noah Van Sciver. I read this book. I read Volume 1, I think, a year and a half ago. Paul came and visited. I picked it up on a whim at a bookshop that we went to. And this book was so funny. I was bursting out laughing, like walking around my apartment going, oh my God. The jokes in this book hit so hard. For those who haven't heard of Fonte Bukowski at all, Noah Van Sciver is a creator at Fantagraphics, and he started writing this book about this guy who's determined to be the best writer, and he's going to live off of mom and dad's money, and he's going to make it, and he's the best writer that's out there. He's going to work for HarperCollins. He's going to write for all these different publishers. But he's just pathetic, and he embodies all of the bad things about creative types who think they have it all or know everything. And, you know, go to the limits to try to emulate all their favorite writers out there. Like this guy, Fonte Bukowski, that's not his actual name. He made this name up because he wanted to sound like one of the great writers. And so, like, all the pretentious bullshit of that is essentially this book. It's a huge satire piece. And the first one was great. I loved it. The second one is bigger and longer and has way more humor packed into it. Noah Van Sciver writes himself into it about how he's a piece of shit cartoonist. And I really enjoy that, the commentary on just all of these creative types, because I don't see that very often. So very good book. Fonte Bukowski 1, I believe, is part of the I Read Comic Book Summer reading list. So if you like book 1, I highly recommend picking up book 2. And that's what I read. Now that we're already way past all the time, let's talk about what we're excited for this upcoming week. Comic books come out on September 20th. So Nick, let's start with you. What are you excited for this upcoming week?
Sure. I'm really pumped for Bloodshot Salvation number 1. Jeff Lemire has now been writing Bloodshot in some capacity or another since he co-wrote The Valiant, which I think was December of 14, maybe, even. So he's been doing this a long time. This arc is going to be sort of a multi-part story, half of it taking place in the present, and half of it taking place 8 years in the future. In the present, it's going to deal with what Jeff Lemire told us we were going to get several months ago, which is that Bloodshot is going to fight Nazis. I was like, okay, sounds good. I mean, this book has a lot of
how timely
violence, so it's also a meditation on violence at times. It is Jeff Lemire. It's not Rob Liefeld or any other. I'm kidding. There are obviously other people that do a lot of violent stuff too.
Sure.
Mark Miller. Shout out. And God, love him.
One thing I left out this week is I've read like more crossed issues than anyone should ever read in a like Tia, lifetime.
Are you okay?
Like an arc.
And so,
oh my goodness! I feel like
Comixology
need to buy you, like,
has like an auto little pop up that after like five issues of crossed, it wants to just check in with you.
Are you okay?
How are you doing, bud?
So yeah, but yeah, I know I feel you on the like oh, this creator, I almost didn't want to know you could be this depraved.
Right. You got curious to see what Cy Spurrier was doing on Crossed, right? Sorry to interrupt.
I'm sorry.
Totally. Okay. No, you're totally right.
But it's interesting because it goes back to Bloodshot's girlfriend, Magic, and apparently her family is a whole bunch of white supremacists, apparently, and they want their daughter back. Oh. And I was like, well, is this coming out of left field? Is this like some Deus Ex Machina bullshit, Jeff Lemire? And so, of course, because, again, let's go back to this is how I spend my time, this is how I spend my brain power, I went back to Magic's first appearance in Bloodshot Reborn 4. Mm-hmm. Where he shows up when her boyfriend goes crazy because the nanites take control and he tries to mass murder people and she ends up killing him. And sure enough, comic you know, books. He's talking about like wanting to purge things and, you know, things, you know, so-and-so will rise up again and he wants to cleanse the earth. And there are several symbols of the Confederacy that are featured prominently within that scene. And I don't want to get into the mess of what is a symbol for what and what represents what, because that's a whole nother mess. But obviously, if you want to lightly connect the dots there, the bottom line is Jeff Lemire did actually sow the seeds over a year or two ago for the idea that Magic's family and friends may be a little bit participating in some questionable extracurriculars, I guess you could say.
They're so, Nazis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. In some capacity, yeah. So, yeah, I was impressed that Jeff Lemire, go ahead. He's doing the work. What can you say? And then the 8 years in the future is following his daughter, who inherits his powers, and her name is Jessie, and she is being chased by this, you know, group that I don't know if they want to experiment with her or if they want to figure out, or if they just want her dead, but it's called Omen. So of course there are a lot of questions. A lot of people have read into this that this means Bloodshot's going to die at some point because generally the nanites don't leave your body unless you're deceased. So a lot of questions. Looks like a multi-part narrative. The art looks fantastic from Louis LaRosa and Miko Suwayan. Very excited for this.
Cool. Tia, what about you?
I'm really excited for Mirror Number 8 by Hui Lim and Emma Rios. This book is just so gorgeous. I don't get why everyone isn't reading it and just like transcending to a new plane of existence because that's how beautiful it is. And in the first story arc, it took place on this colony and there were these like sentient animals and the people there were trying to kind of harness this particular kind of magic. And then when that mm-hmm. story arc ended, we went to this other story arc that was also kind of looking at magic and the nature of being and stuff like that. And now they're converging. The survivors of this colony are going to come back to the Synchronia and now they have to kind of figure out where they fit in there. I don't know. I got to meet Emma Rios at Rose City Comic Con last weekend and chat with her a little bit. And she just is such a thoughtful artist and creator. And, you know, I mean, I don't like necessarily put a lot of primacy on the like author or the artist's intentions, but it is really nice to know that the creator is putting into the book exactly what I'm getting out of it. That just to me means that the book is really well done.
That's awesome. I need to read this book. I feel like I'm doing a disservice to comics by not reading it.
It's true. You really are.
Mike Rappin, comic books, new shame.
Yeah.
It's just, it's really beautiful. And since you're an art historian now, because you went to the Louvre, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. Get on what a dork. God.
Yeah.
Mike Rappin stares longingly at a painting for 5 minutes. Yeah, that's pretty good.
I mean, pretty much. That's what I did.
This one's good, too.
Wow, this whole room is full of good paintings, guys.
I bet your mom's real proud.
So, for me this week, I'm super excited for Bitch Planet Triple Feature Number 4.
That's my new graphic novel, Mike Rappin, Art Historian.
looking forward to that one shot. Bitch Planet Triple Feature Number 4. Really excited about this book. It's not the regular series, and I'm okay with that. I've really enjoyed what Kelly Sue and Valentine Delandro have managed to put together. I don't know who's in charge of assembling all of these artists and writers and everything to make these little mini stories and these issues, but holy shit, it is like immersing my brain. It makes me want to go back and reread all of the actual Bitch Planet issues for the main storyline, just to feel like I understand the rest of the world now. Bring me into this one, like, personal storyline that's happening in the story, and they're kicking so much ass with these little one shots. I cannot express how cool it is to see them flesh out the story the way that they're doing this. It's kind of like what they're doing with Lazarus Plus 66 over on the Lazarus title, just to add more value. I mean, Greg Rucka was already adding a ton of value to his book in the back matter, but and Bitch Planet was doing the same in ways of having commentary in the form of essays in response to the individual issues. But like this book is so enriching, and I cannot stress enough how important I think the book is, and these triple feature issues are doing just as much work as the main story narrative. So hell yeah, Bitch Planet triple feature. I love this series. I'm digging it so much.
Don't forget, Rucka loves that shit so much. He even put out two one-shots that are strictly lore.
Right, right. I'm waiting for my Bitch Planet Bible to come in the mail, right? Yeah.
I gotta say, their fan base is so patient. It's amazing how patient they are with the fact that this is a book that has put out, what, like 10 issues in like 3 years or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Oh, Bitch Planet.
Sorry, Tia, go ahead.
I got a Lazarus Challenge coin at Rose City Comic Con.
Okay.
Watch out. I'm going to use it at cons now to get free drinks.
Tea is so cool, guys.
Yeah. You know, you're no Mike Rappin art historian, but I mean.
Yeah, I'm a disgraced art historian. Mike's the real deal. Well,
Mike's the new wave.
Our show this week is all about our favorite inkers, colorists, editors, designers, so on and so forth. The people in comics that you probably don't hear about or read too much about unless you're, you know, really looking for that kind of information. And so we're going to spend today's episode not necessarily listing a bunch of names, but talking about the bigger idea of the unsung heroes of comics. We've got a bunch of notes here and stuff like that, so let's just kick things off. Tia, do you want to start the discussion about, you said also editors in big caps in our notes, what's the bigger discussion here, I guess, in terms of the unsung heroes of comics?
Yeah, you know, it really, this way of thinking where the writer and then to a lesser extent maybe the artist, if they're, you know, a creator-owned book or something, the idea that they are the sort of main attraction and everyone else is supporting cast, this really goes back to antiquity. Like, it's very, very entrenched in Western thinking about art. And it so artists in antiquity were basically considered no different than carpenters or, you know, anyone else who worked with their hands. There wasn't really any idea of a creator or an author in the way that we necessarily think of it. And art was basically labor. And so in the Renaissance, you know, when you start getting into who I call the Ninja Turtle artists. Yeah. They, you know, so the Renaissance itself was this time when humanities were really flourishing, and the idea that individualism was a thing that mattered, and this led to the idea that a creator was someone, and that art could be tied to that. And so it was like sort of the perfect storm for this really fundamental shift in the way you think about artists. You know, so artists were like, look, we're engaging with these really high-minded ideas where we have to know history, we have to know religion, we have to know Latin, we have to, you know, we're engaging with elite ideas, and we're also engaging with elite people because they're our patrons, and right, they really wanted to elevate their status. So they worked really hard to sort of recast their role in society as people who were using their minds and who were not just using physical labor to make art. And so they become creators. The artist becomes genius. The artist becomes the author. And mm-hmm. that helped them kind of permeate the boundary and eventually become a little more recognized. But they had to do it by basically saying, no, no, it's not the work we do with our hands that has value. It's this intellectual work that we're doing. And, you know, so you'd have these workshops where apprentices would do a lot of the like manual labor part of making the art. I mean, even now you have that with like, you know, name a flatter, you know what I mean? It's like, that's kind of how it was. And so the problem with that is the idea that the intellectual part of art making was the important thing just became really overinflated as a concept, you know, and so now we're left with kind of this vague awareness of the idea somehow being more important than the execution, and that we have to parse those things out and separate them in order to really look at and understand art. Mm-hmm. And because art criticism, you know, Vasari and all these guys in the Renaissance, and then, you know, art criticism just built on that. It never really went away. So now we think that the artists are the geniuses and everyone else just kind of makes their creations happen. And that's really not true. And that's really not fair. And yeah, you know, here we are.
So when we're thinking,
Mike, is that your professional opinion too?
I mean, or, as someone,
I'll give you a chance to weigh.
As someone who visited the Louvre. No, I think that's great, because when you think about a comic book, it is definitely not just writer, penciler, right? And that's usually who we tie a lot of books to. We usually say, oh, look, it's Brian K. Vaughan and Marcos Martin, right? And it's maybe that's not the best example, because Marcos Martin also does some coloring and some inking, but
well,
nonetheless,
it's not
I think
even
the
in the movies,
stands.
It's like director and actor.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Those are the two that's things that sell. And then it's like, totally. Well, who's the director of photography and who's in charge of your special effects? And
right.
Yeah.
And as we, you know, I think as you get more into that medium, you get more into the comics medium, these quote unquote unsung, less noticed roles such as inkers, letterers, colorists, flatters, designers. You know, these names start to become things that you recognize. You go, oh, well, look at the way that, you know, inker X inked over, you know, penciler Y versus how inker Z inked over penciler Y. That was a really hard sentence for me to form in my head. You know,
almost
and my
math problems.
Yeah. And I talked about this kind of on the, you know, the Old Man Logan episode that we did about Dexter Vine's inks over Steve McNiven's pencils. I think it's significant in terms of difference compared to anyone else that has inked over Steve McNiven's pencils. And that type of thing is very, very important. You look at why Todd McFarlane was such an important person in comics in the 90s, not only for his pencils, but because the guy is a stellar inker. Like, if you look at his pencils with someone else's inks, it's a day and night difference compared to when he inked his own stuff. So when you're thinking about, you know, like, what makes this book really good, like, to hark back to what Nick was saying about Chu earlier, you know, Chu is a very interesting book. Rob Gilroy does a fantastic job on, he does all of the art, if I'm not mistaken, for that book. But the one thing that he does not do is the lettering. And John Layman, who's also the writer of that book, does a spectacular job with the letters in that book. He knows how to make the comedic flow work in terms of just how the page is laid out with the thought bubbles and the captions and even just the fonts and crazy weird lettering bubbles that they use to emphasize different points of speech. I know I've talked about this on the show before, but I really cannot stress it enough how important that aspect of the book is when you're actually reading it. And it's something that I think people, you know, we really undervalue when you're not in the middle of the shit like we are, you know, and that's why an episode like this exists, because these types of this work really adds value to the book. Without these inkers and letterers and colorists and designers, these books would be really flat and boring.
That's really interesting. I never thought of how if you have your writer do the lettering, it really allows a more deft control over comedic pacing. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I would argue that inkers are what give depth and movement to the art, you know,
totally.
Notice the way that the lines connect to each other. Notice the thickness of the lines. Notice the way that shadows are made with inks and things like that. And, you know, we think of pencilers as the artist because they come up with it out of their brains,
right?
You know, the writer tells them right. what to come up with out of their brains if you're doing that. But like, you know, the inker has to figure out how to take these pencils and outline them in a way that still makes them feel three-dimensional or give, you know, or actionable.
Depth and texture.
Yeah.
There was... I'm going to bring up my Kevin Smith thing here, if only because I love this. We're talking about inking. There's a scene in the movie Chasing Amy, and this is not a commentary on Chasing Amy because that movie is kind of weird in a lot of places, but ultimately there is some fun commentary in comics or about comic books in that book.
And there's inside a scene, baseball commentary.
Very inside baseball. But there's a moment in the movie where a guy comes up to get his comic book signed, and Brody is the character, I believe, in the book, or in the movie, and he's the inker on the book. And the guy goes, "Oh, what did you do?" He's like, "Well, I did the inking, and I did some of the coloring," but he points to Ben Affleck's character. He's the guy that did all of the penciling. So if you want to get the artist to sign it, you know, make sure to get him too. He's like, "Oh, wait, so the guy who's at the table says, so you're just the guy who does all the tracing? Like, that's what you do as the inker? He draws the actual art and you just trace it?" And so they get in this big heated argument and it becomes a reoccurring joke throughout the movie. But the idea that an inker is just a tracer is very funny to me and has always been funny to me because I never really thought about inking as being that. I always understood it to be shadows and adding, like we were saying, depth. Because if you look at the difference between a page with just pencils and you look at that page with inks, it's literally day and night because of how much actual extra work the inker has to do to figure out everything. They have to interpret the scene. Is it daytime? Is it nighttime? They're the person that determines how the light works. And then the colorist has to go on top of that, interpret how the color works in terms of light. And it is not a single person effort, to say the least. Mm-hmm. Which is why you'll see a lot of pencilers who actually do their own inks, because they want that control over how the page looks. And then a colorist will come in and fill in the color and do the rest of the work in terms of setting the actual tone of the page.
And colorists have to be, I think, really sensitive to inking, because sometimes the colorist is the one who's adding the dimension and the texture and things like that. But if the inker's already done it, like, you don't want to fight with what they've already done, or I don't know, like all of this is to say that you can't just kind of have an assembly line where no one's talking to each other about what they're doing. And that's mm-hmm. why everyone is involved in the creative process in a really important way. You can't just be like, oh yeah, well, the penciler and the writer and then everyone else just, like, you know, filled it in. It's like not how it works.
Yeah, exactly. One thing that I think is really interesting, just to talk about something more recent, I believe Wicked and Divine 31 had a page that was Ball in a panel by himself. It's just like a bust shot or a headshot of him. And I remember Kieran Gillen or Jamie McKelvey tweeted the inks just for that page and then the colors later. And to see how much work went into that page that was just inks and to see how the color changed that was astounding. Like, the page is heavy, like black colored from the ink, but then you add just a small layer of color on top of that and it's a stark, beautiful image of this man saying something. I won't spoil the book, but it's a fantastic example of how important going from pencils to inks to colors is on a page like that. So if you haven't seen that, look up Wicked and Divine 30, you know, issue 31, and then go find those tweets from Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey. It's fantastic stuff.
I'm so pumped that they're re-releasing Vision in the director's cut. Like, they're collecting like a couple of issues for each one and putting all the process stuff in the back, because, you know, you get to just see from script to page, you know, how it gets there. And it's truly so lovely and so interesting.
Yeah, if you need some behind the scenes DVD commentary, that's... Or Blu-ray commentary, I guess, is what we should be saying.
Comics commentary. We don't we don't need that medium. We have our own.
Yeah. So, okay, let me ask the question that I think may be going through a lot of people's minds. You mentioned earlier, Tia, like someone who's a flatter on a book. And I've heard this term being thrown around a lot. I actually don't know what a flatter is when it comes to a comic book. Could you give us like a brief overview of that?
So I actually didn't know really myself. And I was talking to some people about it at Rose City Comic Con last weekend, and they were explaining to me that it's like they basically just... So if you looked at, for example, some artists like Russell Dodderman, they when they draw hair, they like they go to town on like every strand, right? Is drawn. And yeah. So let's say you have Thor standing in front of something going on in the background and his hair is like being whipped around in the wind, you know, so like it's not, his hair isn't going to be just like a mass. There's going to be like strands and there's gonna be like stuff behind them and like what's sky and what's a person and what's a rock and what's, mm-hmm. you know, and so a flatter will go in and they'll be like, okay, here's all the hair and here, this is all sky and this is all this and this is all that. And it's not the color that's going to end up being that color, but it just like saves the colorist from having to actually go in and figure out what mm-hmm. is what.
Gotcha.
That's
sort of, yeah, yeah. You know, so set the basic tones.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. So they just kind of separate out like what is probably going to be what color, like what it, mm-hmm. separating this out from that when things are over, you know, I mean, a lot of these artists get really, really complicated in their drawing, and that's mm-hmm. why we love them. And that's, it also makes spectacular colorists, you know, shine. But yeah, like it just, if colorists work on a lot of books in a month and they just, you know, they sometimes don't have the time to like go back and forth with an editor or a writer or an artist and be like, oh wait, actually that strand's supposed to be sky. Oh wait, actually that strand's supposed to be this. You know, it's just, yeah.
Jeez. Oh, okay. This is totally news to me and I'm just trying to imagine being that person, and that sounds stressful. Right? Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and you can't appreciate the work that a person does if you don't know what the word means even. And
right.
And I don't think that there's ever really been a good medium to. So I have had my rants about comics journalism, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Comics journalism, in my opinion, is one of its mandates is to help people know what they're looking at and help people understand how it came to be, right? Like,
right.
I really wish that we saw more discussion of these unsung heroes, as we're calling them, mm-hmm. when people are reviewing or critiquing books, because that is the way people are going to know and appreciate these things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think the struggle is that for people like us who want to discuss these things and shine a light on them, frequently, at least I feel that I don't have the resources or I don't have the ability frequently to responsibly say, you know, this was a good job of pencils, or this was a great inking job, or this was a, you know, it's difficult frequently to know that you're responsibly attributing success to the right person.
So there was a thing that Kieran Gillen tweeted recently about this, where he was talking about an old Phonogram review where they mistakenly believed it was made by someone named Gillen McKelvey. And so
ooh.
They did the entire review, Jesus. Based on the premise that it was made by one person and that it was actually really interesting, because
oh, sure.
you can't, you know, with a really close collaborative team, you actually can't know what one thing was done by one person. And in a way, it was a more honest way to look at things. You know, so it's... I think that there's a way to say, like, oh, wow, this is a really intricate page. The flatter must have done, you know, some really hard work here. And or, like, the flatting is really good without necessarily saying who did it. You know, does that make sense? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah, it's tricky. There was a quote in this Jack Kirby book I was recently reading, and it was sort of about the plight of inkers, because when the inker these days, when the inker does a great job, frequently people just go, oh, the pencils are good. And when the inker does a bad job, then the penciler gets thrown under the bus and people go, oh man, these pencils are terrible. And so we don't always get that separation to say who did what. But if you're getting at more of looking at it as a collective finished product and saying, you know, this was as a group, this was a great job. I think on some degree that's maybe easier to pronounce and
true.
Still honest in some fashion, obviously.
On the other hand, you also like that only works if everyone is getting credited prominently.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. How many books don't have flatter credits? Right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm getting at. I didn't really realize that how how many books actually use flatters until I read the letter column, or I read the, you know, writer notes online, or I read, you know, something like a tweet from somebody saying, oh, well, we had a really good flatter, that way it made my job a lot easier as the colorist.
Here's a hint: if you know any unusually prolific colorists, there's usually a flatter.
I mean, I think that you can't praise a book's collaborative effort if you're only naming the penciler and the writer.
Right. Totally. And I think that's just because the modern look at comic books, and I shouldn't say modern, it's been going on forever, is that the inker and the letterer, for a lot of people, that's... they're just there, you know, that's, oh, those are the letters and that's the ink, and it's not seen as something that can have a creative capacity. It's more of a utilitarian
sort of laborers.
Like someone has to do this, right, and someone will do it, and it's grunt work, it's legwork. That's how it's seen, which is so unfair.
I mean, it was purposefully sort of defined that way in the Renaissance in order for artists to elevate their status.
Yeah.
You know, and the idea would be that you wouldn't, that everyone wanted to be the artist, and then eventually, like, the person who was, you know, like, doing the, I mean, they had flatters in the Renaissance too. So, like, the flattery, I mean, truly.
Everybody's had assistants.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
that goes on forever.
The idea would be that at some point you would graduate up. But obviously, that's just kind of a silly way of thinking.
Until then, someone else would take credit for your work.
Yeah,
basically.
So it's interesting, you know, the word assistance is actually very interesting in terms of manga, because in the back of a lot of manga books, or especially in like the collected volumes or tankobon, like, you'll see the creator of the book, you know, usually it's one, maybe two people, they'll be the people that are like associated with the book, but those assistants will usually get credits, or they'll get like special thank you pages in the backs of those volumes to say, like, you know, these are all the people that helped on this book. It's not just, you know, me or me and this other, you know, these two people. There's usually like four or five or even six assistants who are working on backgrounds and fills and all this different stuff, and the assistant system, I think, in Japan in terms of manga is in order to break into the industry, you usually start as an assistant and then you move up, and that's like an understood flow. But I think in
Western... believe Drake covered this in a song, Michael.
I think in Western comics, that flow of how you grow in the comics industry isn't nearly as clean cut. So
it's not so much of a pay your dues thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you can break in immediately as a penciler, or you can maybe start as a colorist, or start as an inker, or so on and so forth. And I think getting to a point that I have here in the notes about, you know, you see some people like Jordi Belair, for instance. I think she's our golden child example of how things work. And she may be one in a million, but she is the example that we have, at least, where, you know, she's been a colorist for years. And, you know, everyone, I think, on this show has praised her work immensely. And now to see her move from colorist to writer position is very interesting, because those aren't a directly related field, but I think a colorist understanding of a narrative and understanding of scene and understanding of how, like, a story should be told in terms of visuals is very, very important. So to see her move from colorist to writer maybe isn't that hard of a leap, like, or that big of a jump, but it's something that was very interesting to see. You know, she quote-unquote put in her dues, and now she's writing a comic. I think it's really interesting to see her grow like that as a creator.
But I also feel like that way of thinking really reinforces the problem. You know, like, colorists, it's not just that they're doing important work that needs to be done. Like, it's a it's an artistic and creative contribution in its own right, and
everyone has to be viewed as a storyteller, on some level.
Like, I don't want to be like, oh, one day you could be a writer too. It's like, I actually think that probably, like, a really good way of phrasing this maybe is that her experience as a colorist and as such a prolific and creative colorist is going to make her writing really interesting, because she has this other perspective that people who are writers but have never been colorists, you know, probably won't have.
Yeah, that is absolutely true.
Go ahead, Mike, yeah.
Sorry, not to put words in your mouth.
Me.
No. You phrase what I was trying to say much better than what I said.
It used to shock me when you would see people sort of hop between different roles in comic books, and at least on some level, I felt that maybe skills didn't translate. But over time, as I've gotten older and maybe ever so slightly wiser, I think you just sort of see that just spending time in comics, period, just sort of helps inform you on all these different things. And you're, like I said, you're contributing to the narrative already in some capacity, and now you're just changing it up. I do want to say that doesn't always work. That doesn't always translate. I hate to rag on him, but I don't like his stuff. So Tony S. Daniel is a very prolific penciler, still is. And I guess some people like his work, but he's hopped over to writing, and I, you know, not everybody can be Jordy Belair, I guess. I guess that's a no-brainer.
We should all aspire to be Jordy Belair, yeah, I think.
Not really should. We can,
But really,
but that doesn't always work.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point, Nick. Like, we're not trying to rag, but and yet here we are. But like, you think of Image Comics, like the foundation of Image Comics was a bunch of artists.
I see where you're going. Yeah.
Saying that, mm-hmm. like, hey, you know, we can make these comics ourselves. We want to own our properties, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, they started this company, and you know, a lot of the books that came out of it, some of them were duds. A lot of them were duds at the beginning. I mean, Image as it is now is, you know, one of the bigger names in comics.
Visually strong duds, but yes.
Yeah, but I think that the point was, you know, these artists, they were mostly pencilers, inkers. They decided, let's make our own comics, let's write and draw them. And, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of them didn't work, but ultimately Image survived because they did find out, like, what could actually sell. And you saw books like Spawn being written and drawn by Todd McFarlane to start. And then eventually, you know, McFarlane moved just over to penciling and inking. And, you know, Neil Gaiman came in and started writing. And then we saw that happen with a couple of other different books. Different creators jumped on to say, hey, I want to create these, you know, creator-owned books on a label that had, or I should say, a publisher that has a lot of clout because of all of the big names that moved and started over at this company. And it's, I mean, not to say that, you know, it's impossible to move from, you know, artist or from penciler, inkler, or colorist or whatever to writer, but to just add some value to what Nick was saying. It doesn't always work, but if you look at mm-hmm. Christina Strain, who's writing Generation X, it totally fucking works because she used to just be a colorist, and holy shit, Generation X is amazing. I can't say that enough. She's my other example.
There's a really interesting trend that also exists in art history that I notice in comics, which is that a lot of times the artist's wife will take on some of these unsung hero roles. They'll do the flaps, yeah. they'll do the colors, oh, yeah. they'll edit, they'll
Matt Kent's help wife,
design.
Yeah,
yeah you yeah. know, and it's hard to say whether or not, you know, it happens because they're just there and it's convenient, or maybe they have a genuine interest and that's why, you know, I mean, this is mm-hmm. a book that someone should write, but on the art history side, it's definitely been written many times, but like, you know, the perception of these roles as being not the intellectual work and therefore not the, you know, not the star, not the
master. Not the one worthy of praise.
Right, yeah. Like, yeah, right. So you're sort of like, yeah, whatever, you do that, you know, when it's less, it seems like there's less at...
You're Igor and not Dr. Frankenstein, yeah.
You know, people can really, like, seize that opportunity and turn it into something for themselves.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. I think that part of the reason why we've been able to historically devalue some of these roles is because they've traditionally kind of been, like, you know, the woman's work of comics. If, like, historically, a lot of
colorists were women.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's something I never considered. Because when I think about, like, dynamic duos in comics, right? I think, like, Matt Kent and Charlene Kent, like, on Department H right now, I don't think
the Dodsons.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. Mike Allred and Laura Allred.
The Eminens.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could sit here and name a handful of pairs, but it's when you think about it now in terms of, like, I would love, you know, I think any of those pairs could break apart, and both of the books created by those people would be equally good. If, you know,
yeah,
I think that
Mike Rappin advocating for divorce. You sick fuck.
Yeah. stay together for the comics, right?
That's Nice.
Well, just because you aren't working together doesn't mean you have to get divorced. Jeez, Nick.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Fraction and Kelly Sue. Have they ever even worked together? They just, they're just like a power couple, but they don't work on each other's books.
Yeah.
It's probably deliberate. Yeah. That's probably intentional.
I think there's always more to be said about this. I think, like, I mean, I want to wrap up because we've been harping and talking for a million years, and we'll probably do a part three of this. I think now it's what's going to be a regular trend every year. But I guess what do you guys think is going to be the next, like, on the rise thing to notice in terms of comics? Do you think flatters are going to, like, you know, come to prominence? Are letterers going to be the new thing?
I think it's going to be letterers.
Really?
I think it's letterers.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem, I shouldn't say problem, part of the natural evolution of comics arriving where they are is that people have discovered that keeping creative teams intact is a smart thing to do, you know, no duh.
Right.
If you look at, like, Jeff Lemire, Andrea Sorrentino on pencils, Marcelo Maiolo on colors, those three guys follow each other around like crazy. Mm-hmm. And if you look at certain writers and pencilers, they usually tend to use the same colorist a lot of the time. Why? Totally. Because they have a relationship, they have a rapport. And this isn't a problem, but it still is a little bit of an issue for someone who wants to sort of analyze or evaluate a penciler, you know, by themselves, or an inker in terms of their contributions. Like, Greg Capullo has had Danny Meekie forever inking him all the way back to Spawn. And because of that, as much as you'd love to sort of evaluate Danny Meekie in terms of his, like, inking ability, or say, you know, oh, I think he really brings something great to this book, because he so rarely ever works with other people, it's hard to sort of be like, okay, this is what he does when it's this penciler, this is what he does when it's that penciler, which is interesting because he just inked The Forge and The Casting for DC, and both of those issues had John Romita Jr., Adam Kubert, and Jim Lee's pencils within each issue, and he inked all three of them, and he brought out the best for each one, and I thought that was, it was a fantastic, like, display of talent, but you don't frequently get to see something like that because these teams stick together forever, so you can't say, okay, you know, this guy, it doesn't matter what penciler he's on, like, he's got it, you know what I mean? And that's such a nitpicky thing, but sometimes I wish that there was more of that to see.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, I get what you're. It's a hard thing to separate. Like, are you gonna imagine Frank Miller's art without Klaus Janson? Like, that's a tough team to break up. Mm-hmm.
I think that having these teams is part of what is making this trend that I've noticed happen. But and then it's trickling out. But, like, social media, colorists have started to get real loud about, like, hey guys, you know, a lot of what you think is great about art is us. So, like, please credit us accordingly. And especially the art or the colorists who are part of these, like, really well-known creative teams, like, it means something if some really prominent writer is also saying, like, hey, you need to notice my colorists because they're fucking awesome. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I think that was a really big part of what made colorists start to have a little more visibility, and I think I've noticed that now happening with letterers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the argument for letterers is like, hey, you want to know why this book is fucking legible? It's because of me. Like, that'll be great graphic designers.
I guess I should say that's the thing that I'm, like, totally behind these days, is, like, great graphic designs for, like, the pages at the beginning where you have a primer of all the different characters. Like, Valiant does this little thing where they have these, like, intro pages with a breakdown of all of the, you know, dramatis personae and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that stuff. And I think, like, that's for me what I think is going to really be on the up and up in recent years. Or if you ever read Snowfall, Tom Mueller does the graphic design for that book. And for me, that was the best part of that book, where all of the weird, like, geometric, like, neon snowflakes and all these different designs, and just the real professionalism of comic books that seems to be improving these days, especially with, like, non-big two books where you don't have to sit through all these Snickers ads in the middle of your book.
Right. Yeah. I was the other person for in terms of design I was going to mention was Jonathan Hickman. If you look at all of his books,
oh yeah,
like Hickman's all of good, like Ryan everything Hughes is good. Yeah,
yeah. That I mean, I could also see that being big. So I really would like to see like more dynamic, interesting lettering. But that's a discussion for another day. So let's wrap up here. Let's do some credits and stuff. I want to thank the both of you for being on the show. You can follow us all on Twitter. Nick, where can we find you guys on the internet?
So I'm on Twitter at Death Star Plans. I know the spelling's weird. That's DethStarPlnz. It is a private account, as Mike would want to point out, but mm-hmm. if you friend me and you friend the show, and I know that you're not some crazed fan, as if I'll ever have one of those, I'll follow you back.
Yeah, yeah. Tia, what about you?
Nick, that's a lot of work. I'm not going to do any of that. Okay, problem solved.
I'm on Twitter at Portrait of Madame X. Madame is spelled MME. It's the French abbreviation, which Mike can tell you all about because he's...
As someone who went to the Louvre.
Yeah. Let's let the pro handle this, Tia. Jesus.
Yeah, so at Portrait of MME X. And my account is pretty open. You can even DM me. Yeah, unless you're a dick and then I'll block you. But, you know, be nice.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You can follow me on Twitter at Mike Rappin. You can also follow me on Medium, where I haven't posted an article about the X-Men in 2 weeks because I was on holiday.
Were you in France? I heard you were in France.
I was at the Louvre. I went to the Louvre.
Probably never heard of it.
You can also follow the show on Twitter at IRCB Podcast, where we retweet stuff and post things at 3 in the morning when I'm in bed trying to go to sleep. And we post surveys on Fridays, such as the one I posted last week from France, which with the question of who is the Frenchest. I'm very proud of that one. Gambit won, by the way. I don't know how. It makes no sense.
I know. I was going to say, did you win?
No, I should have. I should have put myself on there. You can... Okay. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see what the poll this week's going to be. It's got to be something fun.
In addition to following us on Twitter and following IRCB Podcast on Twitter, you can also follow us over at Goodreads. We have a group. We do polls for our book of the month, and there's one of those. We also have threads. You can talk about this week's episode, old episodes. You can talk about what you're reading. You can talk about what you think about the book of the month. There's plenty of places to display your opinions, which it's the internet, so I'm sure you have some. It's a great place for those. You can also go and visit us at IRCBpodcast.com. That's our website. And if you want to listen to episodes, they're there. If you want to read our weekly pull list documents where we talk about the books we've got coming out this week and what we think about them, they're there too. It's a just genuinely great repository of information and other $5 words.
Please rate the show, subscribe, tell your friends. Our show is love. You love your friends. Show your friends love by telling them about our show. You can also email the show at IRCB@destroythecybe.org. Please reach out. We love talking to you. You can email us about comic books. You can email us about love, life, anything you want.
Oh, that's... I have to answer criticism, those emails.
Mike Rappin's new obsession.
Yeah. Infinity Shred is the best band in the universe, and they also do the music for the show. We love them beyond belief. Xander is the star you follow when you're lost in the desert and you think that there's no hope, but he's there for you. He also edits the show. So thank you everyone for listening. Thank you as always for subscribing and telling us, you know, how much you love comic books and sending us random stuff on the internet. That's always really fun. We've got a lot of really exciting things coming up. Now that I'm back, I'm like at 110% kicking whole bunches of butts for this show. So I'm really excited for what we've got planned for the rest of the year. I hope you're excited. We've got some really super duper exciting news coming, I think maybe next week. So keep an eye or an ear out for that. Preferably not both. So from everyone here at the show, thank you so much. We will check you next week.
Good.
Oh my god. All right, we're done.
Sorry,
we're done.
Like, you and the Louvre is something I can't shake. It's just, it's so funny.
I mean, like... That's a really big fucking building. I, like, didn't know what to do with myself. There was so much
stuff
to see.
It sounds like it.
Okay, I marked the time, so if you guys want to take a break, we can. I need some more water for sure.
All right.
You can come back to me with a fucking 5-minute pitch about this Mike Rappinart historian book. I'm real, real concerned about where the narrative is going to go on that.
I think this book speaks for itself. I think this is... You write right, what I'm you know, or in Mike's
no, actually,
case, you
I've
write
got
what
it.
You don't.
I've got it, ready? Every single panel will be Mike, and he's like wearing like a dorky X-Men t-shirt underneath like a blazer with elbow patches, and he goes to the Louvre, and then so he stands in front of a painting, and then there's like the panel of him standing in front of the painting, and then the next panel he steps backward and he strokes his beard and he goes, that's very good, and then he walks away good. And then like that's basically the exact same thing with like all the different art in lieu for like every
exactly.
single strip.
It's just repeat
with like a different X-Men different t-shirt things. In every single one. Like, where is he doing these costume changes?
Yeah.
He's just like stripping. And then like in the back matter, we could show like panels of him like stripping his shirt off in the gallery and putting a new one on for everyone.
Oh my God.
And it turns out that this whole thing for Mike is actually its own act of performance art. You know, so it's Mike within the Louvre doing his own actual performance. So who's the idiot now? No.
And then at the very end, the Sorbonne gives him an honorary degree.
This is you guys are outlining my next trip to Europe is going
to be. God.
Just like, I'm back, bitches. And they're like, mon dieu.
yeah, I mean, mon dieu.
Dr. Mike is here to look at
Got
your
Got any
art.
Of those palm frites?
Oh, my God.
Oh, God.
Mike Rappin does Europe. I think there's real potential there.